Our lesson today is entitled David's Other Great Sin. Now, just from the title alone, two questions might immediately arise in your mind. In the first place, what is this reference to a great sin? Someone might say, aren't all sins equal in their enormity and in their ultimate consequences? Well, in their ultimate consequences, they are equal because, and this is where I would have to say, one sin is not greater than another because any one sin can send a person to hell. So in that sense, every sin is equal. On the other hand, not all sins are equal in terms of their immediate consequences. To give you an example, let's compare stealing and murder. If you steal from a man, you can always repent of that and return his money or whatever it was you stole from him, okay? However, if you were to murder a man, then that's a different matter. You can't give his life back to him. So in some senses, some sins are greater than others. And besides that, of course, in John 19, verse 11, when Jesus was speaking to Pontius Pilate, he said that those who delivered him, Jesus, up to him, Pilate, had the greater sin. So we know from John 19, verse 11 alone that there is certainly a sense in which some sins can be greater than others. But that's not our lesson this morning. The other point that I would bring to your mind about the title, or the other question that might arise in your mind about it, is that when people think about David's great sin, if I were to ask you, what was King David's great sin? Immediately, what would come to your mind, if you're much of a Bible reader or Bible student, is his adultery with Bathsheba and his subsequent effort to cover that up, even to the extent of planning to kill her husband Uriah. That story is in 2 Samuel 11, and truly that was a great sin of David. But he committed another great sin, and one that you may not be very familiar with, if familiar with at all. And that was his taking of a census of all things of Israel. The story for that is in two parallel passages. One of them is 2 Samuel chapter 24. The other is 1 Samuel chapter 21. So David commanded his general in chief, Joab, to take a census of all of the people in Israel. Joab initially tried to deter David from taking this census. Joab seems to have had a better sense of the wrongfulness of this act. And you may not think that this was a problem. Why would it be wrong for a governmental leader to take a census of the people in his domain? Well, that's something we'll discuss later on. But Joab seems to have sensed how wrong this was, and so he tried to discourage David from doing this, but he was unsuccessful in that effort. David nevertheless persisted in his decree that a census be taken of all Israel. So Joab went about the business of doing that. However, after the census was taken, David began to feel guilty about it. Belatedly, he began to feel guilty. And indeed, God sent the prophet Gad to David to tell him that, well, in essence, yes, you were wrong to do this, and you're going to be punished for it. And I will give you three choices. You can either have your domain invaded by foreign enemies. I believe it was for 3 months. You can have 3 to 7 years of famine, or you can endure 3 days of pestilence or plague. Well, David chose the pestilence, and that killed 70,000 Israelites. But God decided to bring the destruction of the plague to a halt at Ornan's threshing floor, which was just outside the city of Jerusalem. But David was so grateful, of course, for the fact that God had brought the plague to a halt, that he wanted to make a sacrifice to God for this right there on the spot. Ornan, the owner of the place, who was evidently out threshing the wheat or grain, whatever it was, with his oxen and his sledges, offered to give all of the equipment to and the animals to David for this sacrifice on this altar that David was going to make right there on the spot. David refused to accept these items for free. So he bought the oxen and the threshing floor, and ultimately, as a matter of fact, he bought the whole site, whether it was a hilltop or mountaintop, for a site for the temple that was to be built. So he sacrificed the oxen on an altar there. And that brings us to the end of the story. That's the basic story. Before we move into some lessons that we can learn from this story, there are some questions or problems that arise in connection with this story. Some of these questions or problems arise from the fact that there are differences, not necessarily conflicts, but differences between the accounts or the information that we have in the accounts in 2 Samuel 24 and 1 Chronicles 21. 1 and 2 Chronicles are to a large extent parallel to the information that we have in the books of 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. And just as sometimes we have differences among the accounts of Jesus' life in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, so we have differences between these parallel accounts of David's other great sin, as I call it. So I think it would be good for us to look at these. I like to study problems and questions that these Bible snapshots raise, because I think this is a good way of studying the Bible. I mean, to a large extent, that is how we have really, truly beneficial Bible study. We ask questions about the text. When we don't understand something, or when there seems to be some difficulty or some problem with the text, we ask one another questions, and we make an effort to resolve these difficulties that we're experiencing. And in the process, we learn something. Now, some of these questions or difficulties are technical in nature, having to do with numbers, which shouldn't be surprising since we're talking about a census here. But others are more of what we might call an ideological nature. The first question that we can ask here is, why was God angry with Israel? Kind of as a corollary to that question, someone might ask, well, why did God bring a plague on the whole nation of Israel when it's supposedly David is the one who had the problem or the sin? Well, let me observe that in 2 Samuel 24, verse 1, it says God was angry with Israel. So even though David sinned, and he is the one who is representative here of being the one who is being punished through the plague that is brought upon his people, nevertheless, we need to bear in mind that he was the representative or the epitome of a problem which was characteristic of all Israel at this point. So it wasn't just David's sin, it was Israel's sin also. So the problem seems to lie in this instance with David and Israel's pride. They were proud of the status that they had achieved. They were proud of their military successes, of their national strength. And as a result, when people become proud of what they've accomplished, as is true of others, so it was true of Israel and David, there seems to have been less of a sense of a reliance upon God for their well-being and for their protection and for their progress, and more of a reliance upon themselves. What suggests that pride was the problem? Well, this seems confirmed by, first of all, the prior listing in 1 Chronicles 18 through 20. You can see this very clearly. Just one after another of David's military victories is listed. He had even extended his control to the Euphrates River. So he's at the height of his power. He's been very successful in suppressing the enemies which lay around the nation of Israel. And as a matter of fact, Joab seems to have had his finger on the problem when he says in 2 Samuel 24, verse 3, "Why does the king delight in this thing?" And the word delight there suggests that David was really enjoying the fact that he had all of these people backing him up. And let's bear in mind that this was a census not of the whole nation, but of men of military age. And so this all suggests that David was very proud of what he thinks he has accomplished by his own strength, and to ensure his strength and his success going forward, he wants to have some sense at the numbers of men of military age he has at his disposal. But remember, this was true not simply of David, but of the whole nation. Okay, the second question. How could God incite David to act wrongfully, to act contrary to his will? In 2 Samuel 24, verse 1, and 1 Chronicles 21, verse 1, particularly in 1 Chronicles 21, verse 1, it's indicated that Satan was behind this. And some people might ask, well, was it God or was it Satan who incited David to take this step to Israel's detriment? Well, in a sense, it was both. Satan really wants to hurt people. God holds him back, but there are times when it serves God's greater purpose to release Satan to do his nefarious work, and that seems to have been the case here. So God does not cause people to sin per se, but sometimes he allows them to suffer from their wrongdoings or from their inclination to do what is wrong in order to let them see how bad sin is, in order to discipline them and bring them to repentance. And so if a person has a bad heart that simply needs an opportunity to express itself, God's not going to force him not to be sinful. To the contrary, he's going to allow him to express his sinfulness in order that his sinfulness will be exposed, because unless a sinful heart is exposed, then there's not going to be an occasion to correct the problem in the heart. So God's not going to force us to do what is right. Instead, as a matter of fact, If we've got problems in our lives, then he's going to allow those problems to manifest themselves. So God allows Satan to test us, to expose our pride, as was the case particularly with David in the lesson we're studying today, or it might be some other problem that we're having in our lives. So bear in mind that we might think that we're getting away with a problem for a while there, but if we persist in that problem, eventually it's going to be exposed. So you can see examples of this sort of thing in the case of Job. Job was a good man, but Satan raised questions about the essential character of Job, so God allowed Satan to wreak havoc in the life of Job. In Revelation 20, verse 7, it's interesting that it says that Satan was released from his prison to wreak havoc. So sometimes God allows Satan to do his work, to expose people. I will be frank to tell you, if I may, that I am concerned since we're talking about a plague in the time of David, I'm concerned about this plague of COVID-19 and the impact that it is having on some of our own members, particularly. We've had members, again, I will be frank to tell you, who it seems to me have been, you know, hanging on by their fingernails, out there on the fringes. And I am concerned about what this plague is going to do in their case. So we may have something right now among ourselves within our nation, or indeed around the world, that is comparable to the very phenomenon or the situation that, we're looking at in David's experience. Okay, a third point here, and this is a technical one, so I won't spend a whole lot of time on it, although it has three sub-questions to it. If you were to read the account of this plague during David's kingship in 2 Samuel 24 and 1 Chronicles 21, you will see that there are some differences in the numbers that are given. First of all, we might ask, why are the numbers in 2 Samuel 800,000 and 500,000 for Israel and Judah respectively, while in 1 Chronicles the numbers are given as 1,100,000 for Israel and 470,000 for Judah? So there's a difference in the numbers between 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles. Well, with respect to the 470,000 or 500,000 for Judah, I'm going to employ Occam's razor here. Occam's razor, remember, is an adage, a philosophical adage that says the simplest and easiest answer is probably or usually the correct one. Not necessarily, but I think it says probably and usually the correct one. So the easiest way to resolve the difference between the 470,000 and the 500,000, there's a 30,000 difference there, is simply to observe that probably the 470,000 was rounded up to 500,000. That's a 6%, if my math is correct, that's a 6% difference between the two, and so it's probably just a case of a rounding up. What about the difference between the 800,000 and the 1,100,000? Various answers have been given to this, and I'm not sure that I have the right one, but it is worth noting that we're told in 1 Chronicles 21, 5, and 6, and let me get over there to 1 Chronicles 21, 5, and 6, that Joab has a bad reputation. He just really does not come across as a very good man, to say the least, but on this one point, he happened to get it right. He was disgusted with David's command. And he, as a matter of fact, he was so disgusted that he didn't really finish the count. So we're told in 1 Chronicles 21, verses 5 and 6, and Joab gave the number of the census of all the people to David, and all Israel were 1,100,000 men who drew the sword, and Judah was 470,000 men who drew the sword. But he did not number Levi and Benjamin among them, for the king's command was abhorrent to him. Or to Joab. And then it says specifically in 1 Chronicles 27 verses 23 and 24 that he didn't even finish the job. So therein somewhere may lie the difference between the 800,000 and the 1,100,000. So it's possible that in some way the 1,100,000 may include the numbers in Levi and Benjamin, that and David didn't get those numbers. Okay, next question. 2 Samuel 24, verse 13 says the famine was to last 7 years. 1 Chronicles 21, verse 12 says the famine was to last 3 years. Here's one possibility for the difference there between the 7 years and one count, the 3 years and the other count. 2 Samuel, particularly chapter 24, chapter 21 of 2 Samuel tells us about God punishing the Israelites with a famine because they had acted contrary to the agreement that they had made with the Gibeonites years before. And as a result, there was a 3-year famine. So it is conceivable to me that the 7 years mentioned in 2 Samuel 24, verse 13, is a total of even the previous famines. And that what God is saying then is that you're going, here's another case, and I'm going to give you three years of additional famine if you should choose to go this route for your punishment. So in other words, the 7 years might include even the previous years of famine. Also, there's some indication that God might have struck Israel with famine before David repented. It's possible that it took a while for David to realize that there was a connection between the famine they were experiencing and his census of Israel. And so he was told by God, you know, you're going to get three additional years of famine if you should choose to take that as your form of punishment. Okay, one last question about the numbers. This is pretty obvious, too, if you read the two accounts. In 2 Samuel 24, Ornan is paid 50 shekels of silver, but yet in 1 Chronicles 21, verse 25, he gets 600 shekels of gold. Why the difference? I think it is relatively easy to figure out. Apparently, the 50 shekels of silver given in 2 Samuel was just for the oxen. And the 600 shekels of gold in 1 Chronicles was for the whole site. Remember, this is the site where David, ultimately Solomon built the temple. So you're going to need something larger than a threshing floor, or one small spot to build an edifice like the temple. So that's apparently the explanation. The 50 shekels of silver is just for the oxen, perhaps for the sledges, and then the 600 shekels of gold for the whole site. All right. And just one more question, and this gets us back to some more ideological interest here. And that question is, how could God change his mind about destroying Jerusalem? For this, let me refer you to 1 Chronicles 21, verse 15. 1 Chronicles 21, verse 15. There it says, "And God sent an angel to destroy," or to Jerusalem, "to destroy it. But as he was about to destroy it, the Lord saw and was sorry over the calamity, and said to the destroying angel, 'It is enough. Now relax your hand.' And the angel of the Lord was standing by the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite." I think you can see perhaps the difficulty here. You might ask yourself, well, why did God send the angel to destroy Jerusalem to begin with, only to change his mind when the angel got to the immediate outskirts of Jerusalem and was about to destroy the city? I mean, couldn't God, someone might say, have felt this way or figured this out before he sent the angel to destroy Jerusalem? Well, of course he could have. So let me just observe that God didn't change his mind, that from the beginning, he was sorry about destroying Jerusalem. It's just that at that point, he decided to manifest or show his concern or his regret about having to destroy Jerusalem, and held back in a way that was obvious and known to human beings at that point. David was apparently feeling sorry and concerned to the point that he had left the city of Jerusalem itself, gone to the outskirts of Jerusalem, and had gotten to the site of Ornan's threshing floor. This is where the angel had gotten to. So you have a convergence of people at this point: the destroying angel, Ornan himself who saw the angel, and David who saw the angel. And my point is that David had come to the point of repentance where God was willing to acknowledge his repentance and bring things to a halt at this point. So really what we have here is something that is described from the viewpoint of human beings. God sent the angel as if to destroy Jerusalem, only to halt the angel as a means of showing and dramatizing his mercy, his love for his people, his unwillingness to destroy them. But he wanted, this was not something that was so much going on in God's mind as something that was being now exposed to human beings. Okay, having dealt with those difficulties or questions, let's move on now to some lessons that we can learn from this. Okay. And there are four of them that I want to bring to your attention. The first of these is, of course, that I think this is the most obvious lesson that we can learn from it. Pride can lead to ruin. Proverbs 16, verse 18 says, pride goes before destruction. And there are some other examples that I give you there in 2 Kings 20 and 2 Chronicles 26. Those are cases of pride in the lives of Hezekiah and then Uzzah, King Uzzah of Judah. You can consult those later on if you wish. But again, let me remind you that David had enjoyed an unbroken string of military successes. Again, you can consult 1 Chronicles chapters 18, 19, and 20. Just one after another of his victories are mentioned there over all of the surrounding nations. And so when a person enjoys great success, it's hard for him to suppress his pride in that. That seems to have been the case with David. So this was all coming, his pride was coming to a head now and was expressed, his greater confidence in numbers, in a large army, successful army, was expressed in his wanting to have this census taken. You can see something similar to this, by the way, in Judges 7, verses 1 through 7. Remember in the case of the judge Gideon, and God told him, you know, you really have too large an army with you here. You need to reduce the numbers. And ultimately, the numbers of his army was reduced to 300. And God arranged that because he was afraid that the Israelites would say after their victory, oh, it was because of our great numbers that we enjoyed this victory. So this was a problem for the Israelites, and it was a problem even for David on this occasion. Let's remember the contrast here between the young shepherd boy David when he's going up to face Goliath. At that really relatively tender age, he has a great deal of confidence in God, and he expresses it. All he took to face Goliath, remember, was a sling and five smooth stones. And yet, he has intense faith that God is going to give him victory over this giant Goliath. And God does. Now, contrast that David, the shepherd boy, with now King David. And he's enjoyed these military victories. And instead of saying, well, God got me this far and he'll get me the rest of the way, instead, he says, well, I need to count on my numbers. I need to make sure I've got a large reserve of troops here for any additional military ventures I may undertake or for the protection of the nation. Instead of saying, in effect, God got me this far, he'll get me the rest of the way. So he has become very proud, and God needs to suppress that pride and return him to an humble state. As a matter of fact, I get the impression that he committed adultery with Bathsheba to a large extent because he had become very proud and safe and self-confident. So Listen, it's the nature of life for us always to experience problems. Someone has said that life is a matter of overcoming one problem after another. Have you ever noticed that's how life is, by the way? That as soon as you finish taking care of one problem, it isn't very long before another problem, either great or small, comes before you, and you have to deal with that. That just happens to be the nature of life. So I know it may seem like small consolation, but the consolation in defeat, the consolation in problems is that they keep us humble. They're an occasion to experience the humility that we should have. So too much of a good thing, like success, can destroy a person. Now, this is expressed in an interesting way in Proverbs 25, verses 16 and 17, where it says, have you found honey? Eat so much as you need, lest you make yourself sick. So too much of a good thing is not good. All right. The second point I would like to make from this is that what is good in and of itself can become wrong if it's done without proper motivation, and particularly without proper authorization. Someone might ask, and I think I raised this point at the beginning of the lesson, what was wrong with David the king taking a census of his people? Well, nothing per se, but God had not told him to. It's kind of like the situation in 2 Samuel 7 where David wanted to build the temple and Nathan said, go right ahead. And God intervened and said, well, wait just a minute now. Did I ever tell you to build me a house? Did I? It was wrong because God had not told him to do that. So David had to restrain himself. And all he did was to, you know, gather the supplies for Solomon, his son, to build the temple. So it is in the case here with David's taking of this census. Now, taking stock of one's resources is not wrong per se. It's not wrong to know what we've got on hand. As a matter of fact, that can be wise. In the case of the rich fool, as he is called in Luke 12, verses 16 through 21, it wasn't wrong per se for him to make sure that he had plenty of storage for his crops. Rather, he was wrong in thinking that once he had done that, he was self-sufficient and he didn't need God. So that was the problem here with this census. We've already been over this, but we need to bear in mind that David was not told by God to take this census. God had twice commanded Moses to count the Israelites, once at Mount Sinai, and I believe the other occasion in Numbers 26 was in the plains of Moab before the Israelites crossed the Jordan River into the land of Canaan. So a precedent had already been set by the fact that the Israelites were to be numbered, but only when God specifically said, number them. And David didn't get any authorization. He didn't get any command at all from God to count the Israelites. He did this entirely on his own initiative. Okay? So let's be sure. This is important. What may seem good can be very wrong if we do it without God's authorization. The third point. Even great men should take counsel of others to heart. Be careful. Listen to the counsel of others. That doesn't mean you have to do what they say. That doesn't mean that they're right. But even our critics sometimes, though we don't like to hear what they say, there may be a nugget of truth at the bottom of their criticisms, and we can listen at least to what they have to say and examine it to see whether there's any truth in it. I go into that because Joab, as I said before, well, he was a murderer. He was just a really bad man. He was nevertheless, David's general in chief. Of all people at this point, he's the one who gets upset at David's decree to have all of Israel counted. And he tries to advise David. He does advise David, don't do this. Not a good idea. But David does not take his advice. So we need to bear in mind sometimes that even bad people can give us good advice. Years ago, my good friend Mark Lenza told me what his father had said. I have since come to learn that it's apparently a proverb that didn't originate with Mark Lenza's father. But anyway, someone somewhere one time said, and it's true, even a broken clock is right twice a day. So even people who are most of the time wrong, once in a while they get something right. And that was the case with Joab. He was a bad person, but he was the one on this occasion who gave David the good advice. Now, David in the past, when he was fleeing from Saul, he had enough wisdom, and wisdom often consists in the ability to distinguish between good advice and bad advice. David had the good sense at that time to resist the bad advice that his friends were giving him and accept good advice. I won't go into the details of that, but that's in 1 Samuel. So advice which comes from trustworthy advisors especially, it may not be right, but it does need to be given careful consideration. David failed to do that until it was too late. Okay, one last point that I want to make from this story, and that is cheap devotion to God should be disdained or avoided. One of the memorable statements that David made on this occasion is in 1 Chronicles 21, verses 22 through 24. He's at the site of Ornan's threshing floor. By the way, I believe in 1 Samuel 24, Ornan there is called Arana. I don't know if that's a variation on Ornan or it's an altogether different name. Some people say Arana, I believe, if I remember, is his Jebusite name. Ornan is his, because he was a Jebusite, and Ornan is his Hebrew name. I don't know if that's true, but it's not unusual for, the same person to have two different names. But in any event, in 1 Chronicles 21, verses 22 through 24, we see that Ornan said, he had seen the angel. He was very frightened. He said, "Here, David, take my oxen for the sacrifice. You can even take my sledges or sleds that I'm using for threshing equipment. Break them up, use them for wood on which to sacrifice the oxen." And David said something that I think is really beautiful on this occasion, and we need to bear it in mind. And why am I not able to find it at this point here? Okay. Verse 23, and Ornan said to David, "Take it for yourself, and let my lord the king do what is good in his sight. See, I will give the oxen for burnt offerings and the threshing sledges for wood and the wheat for the grain offering. I will give it all." But notice how David responds to Ornan in verse 24. "No, but I will surely pay it for the full price. For I will not take what is yours for the Lord, or offer a burnt offering which cost me nothing." I think that's beautiful. He basically says, "I'm going to refuse your gift. I'm not going to offer to the Lord something that cost me nothing." So this may be the original regifting occasion that David offered, but he refused it. And he gave the full price of everything, as we've already seen. We need to bear that in mind. Why? Because people are inclined today to look for the easiest religion. And that is so common that people think, well, you know, if my service to God turns out to be something that makes my life difficult, then something's wrong here. Aren't we saved by the grace of God? Well, then that means I should be able to do anything that I want to do, basically, and shouldn't be required to do anything that's difficult in my service to God, because God is just pleased and happy for me to give him anything I choose to give him, especially if it makes my life easier for me to serve God in this way. That is wrong. And this example shows that that is the case. In Luke 14, verse 33, bear in mind that Jesus said we need to give up everything for God. Now, that doesn't say all our possessions, everything. That's not saying that we need to give it away to other people necessarily, but we need to give it up to God. That is, surrender it to his control. Our attitude should be everything that I have really belongs all of my possessions, my family. God comes first, and if God has need of something that I have, it belongs to him anyway, and I should give his service priority. And there are plenty of applications for that, but my point is simply this. Sometimes, folks, really all the time, we need to be prepared to do the thing that's not easy. In our service to God, we need to have David's attitude. I won't give to God something that cost me nothing. Okay. Conclusion then. Again, when David was a young, beleaguered fugitive running away from King Saul, who was trying to kill him, as I said, and you can see this in 1 Samuel chapters 24 through 26, he was wise enough to refuse bad advice and accept good advice. As a matter of fact, the good advice, you may recall, was the advice he accepted from Abigail when he was on the way to slaughter her husband and others because of the way he had been treated by her husband, Nabal. You may remember that story. But Abigail, whom as far as I know he had never met before, Abigail was able to convince him, not a good thing to do, David, and David backed down. So at that time in his life, he knew to refuse bad advice and accept good advice. But when he became king, then his pride robbed him of that ability to distinguish between good and bad advice, and that was true to the detriment of both David himself and his people. And yet David repented on this occasion, and as a result of repenting, he found mercy with God, and he erected an altar there at Mount Moriah. Now, this is interesting. Mount Moriah, or the name Moriah, is mentioned only two times in the Scriptures. In Genesis 22, verse 2, God told Abraham to go and offer up his son as a burnt offering on the mountains of Moriah, and David went to do that. But Abraham went to do that. Of course, God stopped him from actually taking the life of his son Isaac at the last moment. But that's where that incident took place, in the mountains of Moriah. Then in 2 Chronicles 3, verse 1, you have the second and last reference to Moriah, a specific reference, that is. And it says there that this is where Ornan's threshing floor was, and also where Solomon built the temple. So it's interesting to me that you have these three incidents involving sacrifice to God taking place on or near Mount Moriah there at Jerusalem. Abraham sacrificing his son Isaac. Solomon building the temple where animal sacrifices took place. And then, of course, Jesus, probably not right exactly at that site because it was probably occupied by the temple itself, but nevertheless nearby, in the mountains of Moriah, you might say, Jesus himself was sacrificed for our sins on the cross. So I'll close with a reading of Hebrews 13, verses 10 through 13, in recognition of that fact. Here you have this motif or this thread, this idea that runs through the scriptures, almost from the very beginning to the very end. God sacrifices or has a sacrifice made. And in Hebrews 13, verses 10 through 13, it refers to Christ's sacrifice. Essentially at the same place where Abraham made his sacrifice of his son Isaac and where the animal sacrifices of the temple were made. Hebrews 13, verses 10 through 13. There the writer says, "We have an altar from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy place by the high priest as an offering for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Therefore, let us go out to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach." That's something wonderful to think about. David found mercy at Mount Moriah, and we can too. Okay, thank you very much.